Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role have elephants played in American life and culture? Modern elephants are, of course, not native to North America, but they've been here since just a few years after the establishment of the United States and have played an outsized role in politics, entertainment, and our collective imaginations ever since. Ronald B. Tobias is here with us to talk about all that. He's professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University and author of the new book, Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. Ronald, welcome to Think.
Good morning.
This is such an interesting topic. What made you curious about the history of elephants in America?
For many years, I had been a producer at the Discovery Channel, and somewhere along the way, I came across the idea that elephants had been instrumental in the development of American history, and I pitched it as an idea for a one-hour documentary show. And they returned to me and said it was just too much of a downer story, and they didn't want to do it. But the idea had always stuck with me because it was so powerful.
From the very start, people who were able to bring them here were looking first and foremost to cash in on their value.
In a way, yes. That would be a slightly...
Too broad statement?
Well, yes, but it was at the beginning of the kind of the American entrepreneurship as it really was trying to express itself in the new experiment that was this country. And so, yeah, they were trying to exploit elephants as a curiosity, but at the same time, they were really exercising ideas about what it did, what it meant to accumulate wealth, and what was it to become a businessman.
The sticker price on these elephants, considering how the value of the dollar has changed over time, is really astonishing.
Well, if you listen to P.T. Barnum, which you'd be crazy if you ever did, but if you listen to him, they were worth an awful lot of money. And in truth, they were, but not nearly as much as he claimed, because he always inflated the value of everything and the size of everything in order to make a point. But back in the day, you know, back in the early 1800s, an elephant was about equal to about 70 head of cattle. A cow would sell for about $15, and you could get an elephant for $1,000, and then it went up from there as it became popular.
Nathaniel Hawthorne's father had a role in the first documented elephant importation?
Yeah, you spoiled my story.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was the surprise. There was a sea captain by the name of Jacob Crowninshield from a family in Massachusetts, a shipping family that had kind of cashed in on the French Revolution in developing Americans' enterprise, moving cargo across the seas. And he came across an elephant in Calcutta and got the brilliant idea that if he could get it back to America, he might be able to double his investment. So he shipped this poor little dazed 2-year-old elephant all the ways from Calcutta across the Indian Ocean, across the Atlantic Ocean, back up to New York. And it arrived there, you know, just as a juvenile that had been rudely separated from its mother. And that became the actual origination of the elephant in America. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's all right. And that elephant was sold so that it could be showcased around and taken to different places?
He showed up in New York City, Crown and Shield, and started to show the elephant in a tavern down in the Battery near where Beaver comes into Broadway. Charged 50 cents, which was a lot of money in those days. Mm-hmm. People didn't stop coming, and he made a lot of money very quickly, and he, in fact, sold the elephant for the astronomical sum of $10,000. To another man who was a Welshman who paraded the elephant from Maine to Georgia, back up and back down again, and then as the frontier slowly started to roll west, the elephant was at the head of the frontier.
Talk about that expression, going to see the elephant, which I hadn't heard before, but it is a really wonderful expression.
It is, and it's kind of unfortunate that we've lost it in our vocabulary now. But it was a very common phrase back in the 18th century and the 19th century. Going to see the elephant had a lot of meanings. The first and foremost meaning meant that if you went to see the elephant, you got to see life as it really was. There was no disguise anymore. And once you cross the prairie, for instance, and you live through the horrors and the trials of moving across the prairie, you began to understand in real physical terms and mental exhaustion what it meant to make that commitment. And so they said that was going to see the elephant. Part of that was coded in the idea that the United States was in the shape of an elephant, that New England represented the trunk, or Florida, depending on your point of view, and Baja represented the tail on the rump of the elephant, with California as the rump. We saw it as a big, sprawling place equal to an elephant, so it became part of our kind of consciousness. And as time evolved, the phrase evolved as well. So when we got to the Civil War, going to see the elephant really meant that you saw the horrors of war. Lots of soldiers wrote back from the battlefield, "I've just seen the elephant, and that's enough for me. I want to go home now." It represented the horrors of Andersonville and Gettysburg and everything that the war had to offer, that was couched in the term going to see the elephant. But as time moved on, it got more meaning. It eventually came to mean a visit to the brothel. And you could say, "I'm going to see the elephant," which was a way of, in New York and Coney Island, a way of saying you're about to have a dalliance.
Elephants are not easy animals to care for in captivity even today, and they seem to have suffered horribly in previous centuries before people knew how to properly feed them, how to attend to their medical needs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And that's the unfortunate part of the whole story, is that elephants came to this country and they rolled west with us and they did everything that Americans did. They went, they worked in the mining camps, they worked in the timber camps, they worked in agriculture. They really rolled up their sleeves and went to work developing this nation. The people who brought them here or shipped them here saw them as commodities, and they didn't really appreciate what it took to, A, feed an elephant. And feeding an elephant didn't just mean putting stuff in. It meant dealing with the stuff that came out of an elephant as well. And they didn't understand the particular needs that elephants had, because they're very sensitive in their feet. They're very prone to tooth disease, which can kill them. Diseases of the foot, arthritis. And since in the early days it made sense just to ship over small elephants, we had no experience with them biologically and learned the hard way what it meant to own an elephant.
Yeah, and when they misbehaved, at least some of that bad behavior might have been linked to the fact that they were in pain.
Very much so. And at first we began to understand over time that it was physical pain. And we just had an example a couple weeks ago of a keeper that was killed in Springfield, Missouri, John Bradford, who was an elephant keeper there for 20-some-odd years. Was killed and trampled by a 41-year-old elephant named Patience. And Patience kind of kicked him, didn't willfully kill him, but she definitely did trample him when he kind of got in the way. And Patience was likely suffering the trauma that her herd matriarch had just died 1 week before. And elephants are extremely sensitive in terms of social position and family and so forth. And they do grieve. There's not much question anymore that they're very deeply sentient creatures. And no doubt it was distressed by the loss of her matriarch. So now we begin to realize and appreciate that they actually suffer psychologically as well as physically.
You know, what's really interesting, Ronald, there are a number of stories in the book that even people who didn't know what to do for their physiological health, people who kept elephants early on recognized that true relationships would form between them and that they would behave differently when they missed a companion.
You know, early American citizens saw elephants as partly divine because of their role that they play in the Bible as the behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
And they also saw them as very sentient creatures. Part of that was a result of circus hype. because the way they were presented to the people were in family units and mothers, fathers, jilted lovers, faithful wives, all in the melodrama of families. But people deeply believe that elephants were capable of sadness, and they were capable of joy, and they recognized people after years, and they were deeply susceptible to pain as well, mental anguish. And as a result of it, the elephant was the only animal in the United States history ever to be accorded a non-freehold status as a citizen of the United States, which means an elephant technically had the right to vote as a citizen of the United States and also had the right to testify in a court of law under oath, which an elephant did in Cincinnati in an animal abuse case. But with that also came the moral responsibility that any elephant that did not abide by human law was found guilty, just the way any one of us as citizens would be found guilty. So they were arrested for anything from loitering to murder, theft, any crime you can think of. An elephant somewhere along the way was probably charged with it and found guilty of it.
I mean, it's bizarre to think about court proceedings where the defendant is an elephant.
They had a hard time getting the elephant into the courtroom, so they had to do it in the hall. And they swore the elephant in, it was a case in which the trainer of that elephant was accused with abusing him. And there's not much question that he was. He had beat the elephant with a stick until it was bloody during a race. But since elephants don't speak English, they only speak elephant, they needed an interpreter. So they asked the trainer, the very man who had been charged with the crime, to interpret what the elephant was saying. And when they asked the elephant directly, "Do you feel you were abused?" the elephant answered through his interpreter, "No, I feel fine."
I mean, did people recognize the lunacy of this?
No, they didn't. There was a certain sense of humor that always went along with elephants. Perhaps the greatest expression of that was during the 19-teens. When elephants were recruited into baseball teams. At first, they were just batters and pitchers, which would put on an exhibition, but they were so good at playing ball in general and so good at hitting the ball, and they taught them how to pitch, that they eventually fielded entire teams, baseball teams, which played each other. The elephants would get confused sometimes and run to third instead of first, or the pitcher would bean the batter, or the batter would throw the bat at the pitcher, but, the crowd just loved it. They absolutely ate it up, and they started a competitive schedule between circuses when elephants would play baseball. Now, how could you not have a sense of humor and watch elephant baseball?
And elephants may be responsible for some early iterations of the circus tent in the United States?
Yeah, there's been some speculation there, and it might be true. Who knows? One of the really early founders of the American circus, a man by the name of Hekaliah Bailey, no relation to Barnum and Bailey, he bought an elephant and started to show it around, and it became so famous that when he moved the elephant from one place to another at night, people would collect on the road just to see the elephant pass by. And so he understood that he had to protect his investment, so he started to put up a piece of canvas to hide the elephant from the public. And it's not too much a stretch of the imagination to think of that canvas eventually became the circus tent.
Ronald B. Tobias is my guest. He's professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University. His new book is called Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Montana State University Professor of Science and Natural History Filmmaking Ronald B. Tobias. His new book is called Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. You can join the conversation now by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Ronald, you mentioned earlier that technically elephants have the right to vote in the United States, and I guess we have to assume they would vote Republican.
They might surprise you.
Independent elephants.
Independent elephants. The elephant as a political symbol has always been a kind of a curiosity because it comes out of left field. And when you stop to think about it, the elephant certainly isn't an indigenous animal. So why wouldn't a bison or a bear or a beaver or a turkey, as Franklin suggested, be an animal that would represent one of our main political parties? Why the elephant of all animals? It's a very long, complex story that has to do with political intrigue and a famous political cartoonist by the name of Thomas Nast in the middle part of the 19th century. There was, at the time, in the old days of newspapers, it was common for some of the big papers to perpetrate hoaxes on their readers. Some of the more famous hoaxes had been the moon hoax, for example, when the story ran that Sir Herschel had discovered a winged race of men on Mars and on the moon. That it wasn't that uncommon that newspaper publishers just had a good time in order to increase circulation.
Mm-hmm.
Then a hoax happened in the 1870s called the Central Park Menagerie hoax. Central Park Menagerie was famous as a zoo, even as it is now in New York, and it had an elephant, a female, named Jenny. Jenny was all by herself at the time of this hoax when it happened. The newspaper, the New York Herald, complained that the animals had escaped from the menagerie and were running through the streets of New York, killing citizens, killing children, killing people on the street. There was a rhinoceros running down Fifth Avenue. There were tigers in one of the churches killing parishioners. And it was a huge story on the front page, actually a 40,000-word story. And if you had taken the time to actually finish reading it, you would have found at the end an admission that it was a hoax, saying, well, none of this really happened, but this is what it might be like if it did. Well, unfortunately, most people never got to the end of the story, and they took the story at face value and thought that New York was being attacked by all these zoo animals on the loose. The National Guard supposedly was called out. People ran to the schools to grab their children. People left business to go home. And New York was in a kind of a state of chaos as a result of it, at least the city. When the hoax was finally exposed, the publisher of the New York Herald, who was famous for being a person who didn't bother to worry about facts getting in the way of a good story, the Jenny, the elephant at the Central Park Zoo, was applauded as being the only animal that did not lose her temper or did not freak out during the great breakout. She remained cool, calm, and collected. And so she became a kind of central figure of an animal that was good under grace under fire. And that became a focus point for Thomas Nast, who used it even in political ways to suggest that the elephant was representative of the Republican vote in America. And it didn't take long before that image stuck. It happened very quickly that Republicans and elephants were indeed one of the same.
So around the same time, the symbol of the donkey for the Democratic Party emerged, and they became so entrenched that at one point somebody decided to let them sort of parallel the race to the White House.
1912, Teddy Roosevelt had been sent away so that Taft would have a shot at the White House because Taft was no comparison to Teddy. And he was up against a school teacher, as he was known, named Woodrow Wilson. Taft, who is a portly man, he weighed over 300 pounds, versus the very slim and kind of pinched Wilson. And some of the promoters at Coney Island, in Luna Park, Coney Island, decided to take the idea literally and race an elephant and a donkey from Coney Island to the White House. And the one that got there first would claim the White House. Because Taft was so big, he was an obvious elephant. And because Wilson kind of looked like a donkey, well, then he was the mule. It was a 250-mile race course that went through New Jersey and then all the way down to Washington, through Pennsylvania and parts of Maryland. And they expected the race to last about 10 days. When at the starting line, Jenny, who was the donkey in this case, took off like a shot and left the elephant far behind. But the elephant, like the tortoise in the story of the tortoise of the hare, kept plodding on and eventually would catch up to the donkey now and then. But they really didn't get that far. They got into New Jersey, and the donkey, who was not shod, she splayed her hooves, and she couldn't walk. And then the elephant picked up a nail, and she couldn't walk. And they had to call the race to a halt somewhere outside of Philadelphia, I believe. But it got a lot of national publicity at the time.
Something I did not know until I read your book was the fondness that elephants have for alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, they do have their dependency problems. In the wild, elephants drink. They'll find fermented fruits, and then they'll overindulge in them. So drunkenness is not something that's totally alien to elephants. And if they can find a pile of sour mash outside of a distillery, they'll have gone to heaven. They'll feast on that sour mash and get totally drunk. And people recognized this right away, and they thought it was pretty funny that elephants would drink with them. Although they could empty a hogshead of beer in no time. Beer and wine were their favorite drinks, but they would drink an entire bottle of whiskey in one sip. They would drink whatever was given to them.
And it's funny to think about how much alcohol it would take to intoxicate an elephant.
You would think, but not as much as you would think. They are very sensitive that way, and they do react to different chemicals and drugs in their environment as well as to alcohol. There are scientists who have studied addiction problems in elephants in the wild.
And they were also used to look at the effects of LSD on the brain.
Yeah, that's a sad chapter in American scientific history.
Yeah.
There were a couple of scientists back in the 50s at a time when the CIA was very active in psychological mind warfare and trying to develop experiments that would show the effect of psychedelic drugs on the mind. Even though there were some experiments that illicitly used human subjects without their knowledge, they did experiment on a lot of animals, and foremost was a couple of elephants that they gave massive doses to LSD. For some reason, they felt that elephants would have a resistance to LSD. So instead of extrapolating for a human dose to their size, they increased it by a factor of 10. And gave these huge doses to these poor, unsuspecting elephants who became ataxic, and they were elephant tripping. Unfortunately, however, one of them died as a result of the experimentation of LSD on elephants. And the article that was actually published in Science magazine really comes to the conclusion that nothing can be learned from giving LSD to elephants.
So was that pretty much the end of their use in medical experimentation?
No. A few years later, another scientist out in California decided to repeat the experiment because he felt that the methodology that the original scientists had used was wrong. And he said it wasn't the LSD that had killed him. It was actually the barbiturates that he had given the elephants in order to try to revive them, that he had overdosed them accidentally on these barbiturates. And he repeated the experiments to prove that was indeed the case. And lucky for the elephant, it was the case. So these elephants did not die. But it seemed kind of a dubious case to champion.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Paul calling from San Francisco. Hi, Paul.
Hello. One of the things you might check into in the history of elephants in America is do the females have tusks or not? Because the Indian elephant females do not have tusks, so they're less in danger from the ivory assassins who are out murdering mm-hmm. the elephants of Africa. And I don't know if the female African elephants have tusks. But
thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Ronald?
They do. Sometimes it's very difficult to tell the difference between a bull and a cow. And they actually, for American circus promoters, they would interchange their sex, often and disguise the fact that an elephant was really a male when it was a female. The big tuskers, as they were called, the ones with the really big ivory, obviously, were the males. But the females will have much shorter tusks, the African elephants. In fact, if you go into the American Museum of Natural History and look at the elephant diorama in the center of African Hall, you'll see that most of them, male and female, do have tusks.
So it's interesting when you say that promoters sometimes would sort of switch their sex depending on what kind of elephant they needed for their shows. And that's, of course, something that used to happen in the Elizabethan theater in the days of Shakespeare. And there was someone who had the bright idea to put elephants in these, like, Shakespearean tableaus.
Elephants turned out to be pretty good Shakespearean actors. The most famous tableau is Romeo and Juliet, and they played that thing over and over and over again. And I don't know how many different elephant Romeos there were, but certainly as many as elephant Juliets. They played Othello. They played Hamlet. They would literally dress them up in costume, and they would come out and, you know, mimic a particular scene. And people loved it because that was the education of the day. And seeing an elephant dressed up in serious Shakespearean tragedy always got a good laugh.
What's the special relationship between elephants and the Brooklyn Bridge?
The Brooklyn Bridge is one of the great monuments of American engineering marvels. In its day, it was almost an idea that was too big to comprehend, that they could actually build a bridge in one giant leap from one shore of Manhattan to the shore on the other side of Brooklyn. I'm sorry, I can't remember if it's Brooklyn or Bronx now. Shame on me. When the bridge was originally built, people were very suspicious about getting on this bridge because they had seen other big bridges fail and twist in the wind and collapse, and they were very reticent to use the bridge. Gradually, people did start to get on the bridge because it was just too tempting not to, but unfortunately, there was a panic on the bridge in the very early opening days. And people got caught in the stairwells on either side of the river, and they were crushed in the stairwells. They were like bodies stacked four or five deep, children, women, and men. And it was an incredible disaster for the time. They blamed the bridge builders for it, but it wasn't really their fault. And the bridge was cursed at that point, that people felt bad that so many people had died on the bridge and they were still reticent to use it. So in order to overcome the bad publicity that went with that, the people who had built the bridge decided that, well, you know, if one of the biggest elephants in the world could walk across this bridge, then it ought to be safe for everybody. So they went to Barnum and they said, would you like to walk Jumbo, the biggest elephant on the planet, across the bridge? And, of course, it was something that Barnum jumped at. He wasn't going to pass this opportunity up at all. So they let Jumbo and 20 other elephants and a variety of camels and other animals walk across the Brooklyn Bridge at no charge. The toll keeper just opened the gate and said, come on through. And the elephants, just in chain fashion, one after the other in single file, walked across the bridge. But they got spooked by the trains underneath. And then they bunched up, the very thing that they had warned them not to happen. Don't let these elephants bunch up because the load might be just too much for the bridge. And that's exactly what happened. And the bridge shook and frightened everybody, but it didn't budge, not even an inch. And so Jumbo proved to the country that if it was good enough for him, then it was good enough for everybody else. And after that day, the bridge lost its stigma.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mushpak in Plano. Hi, Mushpak.
Hi, my name is Mushpak, and I'm calling from Plano. I had a question to the panelist. I kind of forgot the name anyways.
It's Ronald.
I understand the elephant gives a signal less than 20 or 10 decibels, which is below human hearing, and the sound travels about 10 miles. Is this correct, sir?
I can't attest to the fact whether it is correct, but everything that I have seen says it is. That they can transmit at ultra-low frequencies. In fact, they feel it through their legs, through their feet and through their legs, and that's how they can communicate long distances. So, for instance, there have been examples in Africa of slaughters of elephants, whereas another pack of elephants, which is miles away, will be huddled up somewhere, utterly terrified. And the theory is that they transmitted the danger subsonically to the other elephants in another pack.
Ronald B. Tobias is my guest. He's professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University. His new book is called Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with a professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University, Ronald B. Tobias. His new book is called Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ronald, is there such a thing as a white elephant?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. In the American imagination, a white elephant would be pure white, which was part of its appeal when they started talking about elephants back in the 1900s and late 1800s. In actuality, they're not white in the pure sense. They have splotches of white strategically located on their trunk and their legs and portions of their body, which are determined by holy men in quote Siam and Burma of that day, that determined that these were holy elephants and that therefore belonged to the king or belonged to the temple. When Barnum brought over the first white elephant, he brought over a real white elephant, and people were very disappointed when they saw it because of what they were expecting was not what they got. So one of Barnum's competitors, a man by the name of Adam Forepaugh, took an elephant, whitewashed it, and said, see, I have a pure white elephant, and paraded that around until the fraud was exposed.
Yeah, and it was the kind of thing that just made Barnum crazy. You have to wonder if he just didn't think, I should have thought of this first, and I could have saved myself a lot of money.
And he would have if he'd thought of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Sharla in Dallas. Hey, Sharla.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was in relation to what you discussed about the LSD experiment with the elephants. What is the relationship, perhaps if there is one, between those experiments and the iconic, very trippy scene in Disney's Dumbo?
Well, there are really odd connections in that film to things that were going on at the time. And the connection has more to do with the scientific discovery of an element called coronium than it does with LSD. Coronium supposedly only existed in the corona of the sun, and it was lighter than helium. It was so light that a little baseball-shaped size of coronium could lift an elephant to heaven. And in those days, when they believed in coronium, they actually thought that that would propel space travel of the future. They would capture that gas, and it would just float everything through space. So when you see the elephants start floating around in some of those hallucinogenic scenes in Dumbo, and even Winnie the Pooh has one of those scenes in it too as well, with the heffalumps, that it has more to do with the belief that there was this coronium out there that could lift an elephant and make them dance, you know, like ballerinas, or the hippopotamus Hyacinth could dance like a ballerina.
You know, I really enjoyed the book, Ronald. The one sad thing is that we have to go from delightful stories to ones that are much more disturbing. But can you talk about the ways that elephants were associated with the early days of electricity when innovators were in this sort of pitched battle over whether alternating current or direct current should be the national standard?
Well, there was a big shootout between two guns of the time, George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison, about the future of electricity in America. On the one hand, you had Tesla and Westinghouse, who believed in one form of electricity, which is the standard that we use today, which is alternating current. But Edison stood behind direct current, and Edison wanted to prove when he saw he was probably going to lose this contest that Westinghouse was just too dangerous a form of electricity. It was lethal. So he pushed on one front to get Westinghouse's electricity to be used on electric chairs so people would associate it with executions and electrocutions. And he then went out and started a campaign in public, starting to electrocute cats and then moving up to dogs and then moving up to cattle and then finally moving up to an elephant to prove to people that Westinghouse's electricity was just too dangerous to use. So he had the opportunity to kill an elephant in early part of the 1900s when an elephant had killed a trainer, at Luna Park in Coney Island. And the people that owned the elephant, who were the owners of the amusement park, decided that they would do a public execution and try to sell as many tickets to it as they could. Luna Park was still under construction those days, and they were trying to figure out how to turn a negative of a man-killing elephant into a positive. So they went ahead and approached Edison and asked him if he would be interested in electrocuting an elephant. And, of course, Edison jumped on the idea. It was the second time that somebody had tried to electrocute an elephant. The year before, somebody had tried to electrocute an elephant and nothing had happened when they flipped the switch, which led to speculation that elephant's hide was so thick that electricity could not penetrate it. So even though Edison said, "I'll do it," he wasn't totally sure if he could electrocute the elephant or not. But he had a good circuit, and he made sure the elephant had good contact with its points, and he put 50,000 watts or volts of electricity through through an elephant named Topsy, who died almost instantly, and filmed it, which is still, you can go on the internet today and watch the electrocution of an elephant by Thomas Edison and see this elephant fall.
It's interesting trivia. I will say no thank you to the suggestion. It's funny to think that, you know, people were so fond of elephants and yet that people would pay money to witness something so barbaric.
It is paradox, isn't it? It's tough to figure out. They loved elephants And yet there was a campaign during the early part of the 20th century to kill every male elephant in America, which they succeeded by about 1930. Hmm. The reason they wanted to get rid of the elephants is they were male elephants is because they were just too unpredictable. They were aggressive, and they could cause a lot of damage, and they, on occasion, got loose, and they killed people. So the owners decided this is too much of a liability for us. We need to get rid of all our male elephants. So they started executing them one by one, usually with, just with a note, aggressive, comma, euthanized. And euthanasia would take the form of being shot, poisoned, choked, hung, any way you could possibly imagine a way of killing an animal they used on the poor elephant.
Hmm. How did the first sanctuaries for elephants start to be established in this country?
It's a relatively modern phenomenon, the idea of the sanctuary, especially for elephants. And there are really only two major sanctuaries in the United States right now, one called Paws out in California and the other in the middle of the hills of Tennessee. The idea behind sanctuaries is that elephants are really badly treated in this country, which is true. There's more than enough evidence to show how badly treated elephants were and the price they paid, usually their life or at least a dramatically shortened life. So people wanted to build a sanctuary, a place that they could put elephants where they would not have to perform, where they would not have to show up at any given time of the day, where they could simply live in the woods and live out their lives as naturally as possible without the interference of the public coming to watch them. So it's a refuge for the old, the sick, the elephants. There are some that maintain elephants actually suffer PTSD so that they can recoup from those kinds of psychological dramas. And there are approximately, I would say, 30 or 40 elephants on sanctuaries now in the U.S., where they simply live out the days on the land.
And in other parts of the world, of course, their natural habitats are shrinking, and there are, I suppose, efforts that are sometimes successful and sometimes not so successful to preserve that space.
Mostly unsuccessful. Elephants are disappearing at alarming rate, and we hear that about so many species, and you hear it, it's almost incidental. But when you have a creature so big and so fundamental to the fauna of Africa and Asia, that's disappearing so fast that there's no place for them to hide because of the ivory trade. Because of poaching in Africa, elephants in the wild are under as much pressure and receiving as much harm as elephants in captivity. There are very few safe places left for elephants. American zoos and their conservation efforts have done very little to be able to tackle these huge problems in Africa and Asia. The ivory trade just overwhelms anything that we've been able to do. And as an example of that, in Chad, for instance, Chad has about 3,000 elephants in Africa. And the European Union had funded park guards to take on the poachers in that park. But they didn't have enough of them, and they placed these guards strategically in certain safe zones around the country, which ended up being a total failure. And in 2006, the population of the elephants in Chad went from 3,000 to less than 500, according to one researcher. We have not been able to protect them. Most land in Africa is unprotected. We hear about the refuges, but most of the elephants who travel great distances walk across lands where they have no protection whatsoever, and either because of war or because of poachers, they are losing ground at an extraordinarily fast rate.
The U.S. government very recently has been talking about crushing a seizure of 6 tons of illegal ivory. Is this the kind of thing that's necessary to protect elephants, to make sure that trading in that ivory will not be profitable?
as a token and symbolic gesture, you know, would be well received. Whether it would be meaningful in the long term, I doubt it. Ivory is funding a lot of political armies in Africa. It is so deeply entrenched that, and the laws are so shakily written that they're easy to circumvent. There's a wonderful film by John Hemingway called The Battle for Elephants that came out just this last year on National Geographic Television, which talks about the ivory trade and how demanding it is and how much ivory is disappearing into the commercial trade and the effect it's having on the population of elephants in Africa.
It is possible these days, if we're interested in elephants, to sort of watch them going about their business without having to disturb them. Can you talk about some of the technologies that are making that possible?
Well, the question arises about what do elephants serve by being in zoos? The usual answer is education. And yes, we want our children to see elephants. We want to go and see elephants because they're a marvel to look at. They're just wonderful to watch. And most people are aware of the kind of paradox of putting an elephant into captivity like that, which goes against its nature and its psychology so much that we hope that there is a greater good to be obtained from that. Our zoos... cruel. It's a question that for animals like elephants. There are certainly some animals that do well in zoos, and there are certain animals that do not do well in zoos, and elephants is one of them. So what do we do? Do we let elephants disappear from public view and consciousness? I think the answer is that the zoo of the future is the virtual zoo. Places like the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, which is 3,000 acres where elephants go about their daily business, unmolested by people. But that same 3,000 acres has 50 cameras located strategically around the preserve, which are watching everything that's going on during the day. So at any given time, you can get on the web and you can go to places called Africa, Asia, in Tennessee, and you can watch the elephants do what it is they do on their own, not being aware that they're being watched by us. The numbers of people that check every day the elephants online exceed the number of people who actually go to zoos to see elephants. And as we accept virtual reality more and more as a form of reality to see elephants real time on the internet, that we will be just as happy not to spend the $100 or $200 going to the zoo as to see elephants online.
Ronald V. Tobias is professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University. His new book is called Behemoth, The History of the Elephant in America. Ronald, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help today on the phones from Christina Martinez. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.